Judge Hooten, Judge Johnson, Judge Smith, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on this morning's calendar is the State of Minnesota versus Carl Leon Hagerman. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument this morning, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument, and you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent the appellant, the state of Minnesota. This is a state's pretrial appeal of the district court's decision to admit evidence of another rape in a crimsex case. The facts are fairly straightforward. On September 23rd, 2017, respondent Mr. Hagerman sexually assaulted the victim in this case. About a month later, on October 27th, an unknown offender in a separate incident altogether also sexually assaulted the victim in this case. Several days later, on October 30th to 31st, the victim goes to North Memorial Hospital, and she's admitted to the hospital, and she reports that she was sexually assaulted by Hagerman. The next day, on November 1st, the victim stays in the hospital. She's receiving treatment. She's suicidal. She's on a 72-hour hold. The next day, November 2nd, she's still in the hospital, still receiving treatment. The next day, November 3rd, she's still in the hospital, still receiving treatment. But it's on this day that she discloses to her psychiatrist that she has been sexually assaulted, not just by Mr. Hagerman, but also by an unknown individual in a separate incident altogether.
And could I just confirm, because in looking at the briefing, there seems to be a disconnect between whether this second incident not involving Mr. Hagerman occurred before or after. And according to the medical records, it looks like it occurred after. Is that the...
I think there's no dispute that it occurred after.
All right, so very good. I just want to confirm that.
Hagerman's occurred about September 23rd, and the next one occurred on about October 27th, so a little over a month apart.
Mr. Zettler, it seems to me that it would be possible for the defendant to offer evidence of two different statements by the complainant, which are allegedly or possibly inconsistent, without making any reference at all to the other incident involving a different person. I guess, first of all, do you agree with that as a practical matter?
Yes.
And secondly, would you agree that that evidence is admissible?
Yes.
Okay, so the only issue then is whether, well, how would you define the particular issue that we need to decide?
Whether the district court clearly abused its discretion by deciding that the other statement is probably false and therefore admissible as a prior false statement or a prior false accusation of rape.
I think the bottom line is that, the difference between your view and opposing counsel's view is the question about whether defendant may offer evidence concerning her statements concerning another incident involving another man.
Correct.
Is there anything in the record that indicates that her statements relative to the second rape were in any way inconsistent relative to that rape?
No.
And in determining whether to admit evidence of the second rape, if in fact it were shown that her allegation regarding this second rape was false, if that had been shown, then would that be an exception or to the rape shield law?
Yes, prior false accusations of rape are a recognized exception to rape shield.
All right. So in this case, as I understand it, the burden of proof then would that be upon which party in showing that it's false?
Goldstein sets forth the standard of showing probable falsity, and that burden rests on the party trying to show that it's false, so in this case, Mr. Hagerman. So he would have to come forward and establish a reasonable probability of falsity of the prior accusation.
All right, and in this case, what evidence is there in the record that you're aware of that would show reasonable probability of falsity?
There is none. Right. None. And I think that's why, in their brief to this court, they're no longer arguing that it is probably false. They've abandoned that argument, at least in their brief, and they're now simply arguing that due process requires that they be allowed to tell the jury that the victim was also raped by somebody else.
Then how do you respond to that argument?
There is no exception that allows evidence of a separate rape. It's not relevant. That's rape shield. That's, it doesn't get over even 403.
So, as I understand the red brief, and I read it the same way in that it doesn't address that it was probably false, but it talks about inconsistency in statements, which you have talked about a little bit, but didn't go further yet into why they're not inconsistent, which you made. But also a second argument is that related to the expert testimony, and that there will be an expert testifying, and that the respondent should have the opportunity to question the expert about the other incident because that response could have been caused by the other alleged rapist, et cetera. I didn't see you address that argument in the gray brief, but if you could now.
Yeah, I didn't address it largely because, and I think that a respondent will concede this, that was withdrawn at the motion hearing. So on page 18 of the transcript of the motion hearing, the prosecutor very clearly stated, I withdraw that because the prosecutor agreed. I can't split hairs and prove that this much PTSD was because of the stranger rape and this much PTSD was because of the Hagerman rape. So the prosecutor said, I'm not going to do that. I'm withdrawing that. Page 18 specifically states, I withdraw that motion, 18 to 19. So that is...
Then withdrew the motion to...
To present evidence through the expert on that. So the expert testimony was still going to come in as to delayed reporting, but not as to... trying to attribute PTSD to the victim in this case.
And so there was still going to be expert testimony, but about delayed reporting.
Yes.
And is that a basis? I mean, would that, let's assume that that's what is being referenced in here, like taking into account the withdrawal of a portion of the expert's testimony. Why would that not be a basis for admission? That there might have been it, that there's a second allegation of rape and that the delayed reporting, I don't know, that it's relevant to that question of delayed reporting.
I mean, I don't even know that the second incident, it really wasn't much of a delay in the report anyways. I mean, she reported that on November 3rd and it occurred on just like the week prior. So I'm not sure I follow the court's
question.
You
just don't see a relevance, I guess, is my question. I want you to address why that is not a reason.
That is not a reason.
And are you arguing that it's not relevant?
Yes. And to get to Judge Johnson's question, they are free to question and cross-examine the victim about inconsistencies in her reports and statements about Mr. Hagerman's rape. And they're free to question her about the delay in the reporting of the Hagerman rape. But there's nothing, no evidence whatsoever to show that this other true rape, because that's what we have here, in any way influenced her report. There's no inconsistency created. The way that they convinced the district court that there was to say essentially, and I set this out in my reply brief, I think, succinctly, they add an only to each. So there's the only, in all of the records we have, there's only one sentence, this is all based on one sentence, where there's a different kind of penetration mentioned. And that's from Dr. Hansen. And so she writes the statement down from the victim when the victim's under the influence of drugs, and the victim says that one was vaginal and one was rectal. She didn't say one was vaginal only and one was rectal only. If she had, then you might have the kind of inconsistency that I think they would need. But there isn't. And there's not even any other evidence than of any other complaint about it, because when you look at her actual police statement, it's extraordinary. The details and the facts that she goes into about the drumsticks and the forcing her to eat the ribbon. I mean, it is a highly detailed 53-some page police statement describing Hagerman's rape of her, including oral penetration, which is just as guilty as anal or vaginal. And there's no complaint or allegation that the oral somehow changes it, or that they should be allowed to tell the jury that she was also raped by somebody else. There's simply no relevance whatsoever to this case that this victim was anally raped by somebody else. They have pointed out no inconsistency.
Well, and all these arguments that you're raising now as to how the two statements with regard to the first rape are not not inconsistent, those are arguments that could be made to the jury, right?
Absolutely.
So the state will be taking the position you just presented, and the respondent will be taking the position they're inconsistent. So,
yes.
All right.
So based upon my reading of the red brief, it seems like it's not in dispute that the rape shield law and its associated case law does keep some evidence out of the record, correct?
I think that
and
is
so,
true.
And so the issue is whether that the operation of the rape shield law deprives the defendant of his right under the Due Process Clause to present a complete defense. I think that's the issue, right?
Yes.
And how do we answer that question? How do we go about analyzing that?
You have no constitutional right to present irrelevant evidence, period. Case after case after case says exactly that. And this separate rape is irrelevant.
That's so it's made irrelevant by the rape shield law, but let's say in the absence of the rape shield law, would that evidence be admissible or inadmissible?
It would be irrelevant. It would be completely irrelevant. The fact that she was raped by somebody else has nothing to do with her credibility. It has no bearing or showing that her current allegation against Mr. Hagerman is false. So if it doesn't go to any of the items that you would present evidence on, it's irrelevant. And that is what the foundation of Rape Shield is. Aside from the fact that it is Rape Shield, the reason it exists and the reason it doesn't generally violate defendants' rights to present a defense is because that evidence is usually irrelevant.
But I mean, the purpose of the Rape Shield law is to keep out some evidence that otherwise would be admitted without the Rape Shield law, right? I mean, otherwise we wouldn't need the Rape Shield law.
Sure, and if consent were an issue in this case, it's not, but if it were, and you had modus operandi type evidence, that's still covered by Rape Shield, but that's something that would, otherwise without Rape Shield, certainly be relevant. But we don't have that in this case. That's not this case.
I'll explore that with your opposing counsel during her a lot of time.
Critical impact. The state's proven critical impact by suppression or by admission of this. I mean, there's case after case says that. The respondent is arguing that critical impact does not apply to the admission of evidence, only the exclusion of evidence, but cites no case law to support that, and this court has ruled time and time again that that's not true. So Berman and Hawkinson are two cases that are exactly on point that found critical impact under these exact circumstances. Unless the court has any specific questions at this time,
forgive me, I was still formulating a question, but I thought I had two more minutes, but I guess maybe I don't. It's hard. I mean, I'm not sure if we know what the complainant will testify to. I mean, at the moment, I think we're assuming that she would testify exactly the way it's described in Dr. Hansen's notes. But, it seems to me Dr. Hansen might explain the notes, it might testify about the notes in a way that makes them have a different meaning. The complainant might say that she did or did not say what is described there, and so on. So, because we're pre-trial, this is a little bit different than than those cases that review this after trial. But anyway, how does that affect our analysis?
I think they're free to question all of the statements that the victim made about the Hagerman rape are fair game at trial. And if they're inconsistent, they can impeach her with those and question her about those. But there is simply no relevance to an unrelated rape. None. It would be excluded under Rape Shield. It's excluded under even just regular 403. It's not relevant to the case.
Could I just ask you one last question about reasonable probability? Is that the same thing as probable cause?
I don't know. I mean, it appears in the case in Goldstein, and reasonable probability of falsity. I don't know if it's the same as probable cause or not. I don't think we need to decide that here because there's zero evidence of it and they're not even claiming it anymore.
But would you maintain that even if it were equivalent to probable cause, that there's insufficient?
Yes, I would say there's not even reasonable suspicion if we're going to apply different standards here. There's no evidence that the other rape is false, none. And they're not even claiming it anymore.
Can I just do one follow-up? So with respect to Judge Johnson's question, as testimony develops at the trial, though you would agree, I assume based on what you said earlier, if for some reason the testimony came out that, in fact, the complainant said only vaginally sexually assaulted in the first one, that would actually change the analysis at that point. If testimony actually inserted the word only, that the doctor said, oh, she said only vaginal, the complainant testified, yes, I told the doctor only. I mean, does that change it then, based on your earlier argument?
I don't think it does.
Oh, okay. So even if the first report was, in fact, I was only vaginally, right, that would not create an inconsistency that would then permit
that,
introduction
of
the evidence?
I don't think it would, because what you have here is not an allegation of a false rape, occurring, separate rape occurring. You have an actual separate rape occurring. So they're free to impeach her with inconsistent statements? Absolutely. If she says she was only vaginally raped to the doctors, and then later she tells the cops that she was vaginally and orally and anally raped, and not just with his penis, but with drumsticks and forced to eat off the floor, they can impeach her with inconsistencies that way all day long.
But it's not going to affect this decision,
no,
in your view?
It's not.
I see.
All right, well, thank you. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Piper Wold. I represent Mr. Hagerman. As this court is well aware, the standard on appeal is abuse of discretion. A district court judge determined not once but twice that the evidence in question should be admitted in a very, very narrow decision for limited purposes.
Well, could I ask you, are you conceding that there was no evidence of falsity presented in as to the second rape?
I'm not, Your Honor. The complainant stated that she had been anally raped and that in the past she had bleeding and that she was still experiencing pain. There was a physical exam conducted and there was no indication whatsoever of any type of injury.
Well, except I looked at those medical records and she said she was bleeding after that second rape. She said that it was lessened. And then she said it was scant. And then right before the exam, she said, well, I've quit bleeding. And then at that point, they did the exam and didn't find any evidence of any kind of bleeding at that time.
Correct. And they didn't also have any evidence of any type of injury whatsoever. So I'm not just referring to the bleeding, but there was no, the doctor noted that there was nothing of unusual.
But I also looked at the judge's order, and he doesn't even mention any of that.
Well,
in
the
his
judge
order. In
sure.
fact, the only thing he mentions is the inconsistent statements with regard to the first rape.
And I understand that the district court's order did not flush out the issue of potential falsity, although he does indicate that it's his conclusion.
But if I look at his order, he says, well, there's not much in this record, and if I had to paraphrase, the only relevant thing he thought there was these inconsistent statements with regard to the first rape, and he says, based on that, he found there was a reasonable probability of falsehood with relevant to the second rape. I mean, am I misstating what the order says?
You're not misstating what the judge said. I was just adding what the respondents, the other facts that we think are relevant with respect to whether that statement was false. It wasn't reported. The other incident was reported. That makes it different. The judge had access to all of the medical records as well as her the complainant's statement, so he certainly had the opportunity, and I assume based on his order, had reviewed those documents as well.
But don't we have to look at what he found to be relevant and
sure.
and his analysis
sure.
and reviewing this?
Sure. And I think even if we just consider what was in his order, there are inconsistencies, discrepancies in the version of the alleged facts that the complainant sets forth. She
as to the first rape.
As to the first rape.
Okay. What are the inconsistencies with relative to both, the second one?
Well, what I would say is that maybe inconsistency is not the right word. The way in which it was reported, the timing of it, the lack of detail, the fact that she didn't go forward to report that, but reported an event that she claimed took place 5 weeks earlier. All those call into question the veracity of the statement that was made to medical providers.
But you're basically saying that there's a reasonable probability that she is lying relative to the second rape. What in this record can we look at that the judge considered that would support that?
Well, as the court has pointed out, the district court judge simply pointed to the issue of the inconsistencies between what she had told the medical providers and what she had told law enforcement. And Your Honor's correct. That's what the court looked to.
So it's basically if I isn't he just saying because there's inconsistencies on the first rape? I think that the second rape is false. There's a reasonable probability that the second rape. Isn't that kind of circular? Is that the way it's supposed to work under Goldstein?
No, that's not the way it's supposed to work. And I think the judge focused primarily on our first argument, which is that this goes to the substance of the case, not simply that it's, and therefore the defendant has a right to present a full and complete version of his facts. And then as a second argument, the court mentioned the probable falsity of the second allegation.
Well, let's talk about the due process rights of your client. You heard counsel, mm-hmm. the prosecutor, indicate that you can bring up all of these inconsistencies with regard to the first rape. Everything you want to bring up, and I'm sure you will. Mm-hmm. What probative value will the fact that she had a second rape have with regard to those inconsistencies in the first rape?
Well, the position of the defense is whether the second rape occurred or didn't occur. The fact that the complainant made statements to medical providers in which she was very specific. She said that she told three different doctors on November 3rd that she had been raped and that therefore she had been experiencing pain and rectal bleeding. The most specific statement that she gave was to Dr. Hansen, and she says she was sexually assaulted, and Dr. Hansen notes this, writes the word vaginally in September, and then again rectally this past weekend. That is different. She is making a distinction. The complainant is making a distinction between those two rapes. That is different than, and the defense should be allowed to cross-examine her with respect to that distinction. It is different than just allowing the defense to just say, oh, you only said vaginal rape to the medical providers, but now you said rectal, vaginal. That's not sufficient to explain to a jury the difference in her versions of events, because she brings up the act of anal penetration by a different person when she had the opportunity over 7 days to explain that the defendant had done a similar act. That's relevant to a defense, and it's relevant to the defendant being able to explain his version and to point. Go ahead.
So I hear you saying you should be able to bring up the delay in reporting this. Won't you be able to do that anyway?
Yes,
even
Your Honor.
Without that second rape?
Yep.
So how does having the second rape in evidence help you? Because you're going to be able to do that anyway. I mean, what are you not going to be able to argue that you won't be able to argue anyway?
So part of the theory of the case is that, in addition to the delayed reporting, let's liken it to, say, instead of a sexual conduct case, this is just an assault case, and a complainant says, person A punched me in the gut 5 weeks ago, and she says it repeatedly and repeatedly, punched me in the gut, and then all of a sudden, after saying that for 4 days, she then says, oh, by the way, last weekend, this other person, person B, punched me in the head. But person A still punched me in the gut 5 weeks earlier. So then she goes to talk to law enforcement, and all she talks about is she first brings up, got punched in the gut by person A, and then the officer says, but did anything else happen? Did he ever punch you in the head? Oh, yeah, he punched me in the head. That's a different. The jury should understand that that's how her recitation of events transpired.
Okay, but as I understand, counsel for the state, if they're not bringing up any claim or any allegation that she was rectally bleeding from the first rape, how is it relevant to? You know, how does this harm your client in presenting his defense if that's not even brought up?
Well, it's not about whether she had injury as a result of the separate rape. It goes to the way in which she has been describing the incident involving she and the defendant, and so it's substantive. It goes to,
but as I hear you. I mean, it's almost like you want to infer that because there was a second incident, that somehow that incident is a false one, which makes your incident, the first rape, also false. Wouldn't that be impermissible under the rape shield law?
And that's not our intention. Our intention is to show that the complainant's story about what she says took place with respect to Mr. Hagerman changed. Whether it's changed subtly or changed significantly, the defense should have the opportunity to do that. And simply saying, first you said it was just fat, it was vaginal, and later saying it was vaginal and anal doesn't give the jury the full picture of what was stated.
But again, aren't you going to be able to do that anyway? I mean, you're going to be able to pull that medical record out and say, she said vaginal here. She didn't say anything else. And look, a few hours later or shortly afterwards, she's giving a 53-page description. There's nothing that's stopping you from presenting that defense. Am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. We will absolutely be able to point out that initially she said vaginally, and then that's what the state will do is they will explain. Of course, she just gave more detail to the police officer when she had the time to do so. That doesn't let the jury know that not only did she only say vaginal, she differentiated between the fact that by omitting, by stating that she was anally raped by someone else, saying she was raped by my client Badgley, and omitting when she had the opportunity, omitting her later statement that she was rectally anally raped by my client, that is relevant with respect to whether the incident involving my client took place. And that's what we're getting at. You know, frankly, it really doesn't matter to the, and I don't mean to sound insensitive, but my point is not, we don't know what happened with respect to that second incident. What I do know is what she stated about it with respect, while at the same time simultaneously discussing the allegations against my client. And that's why it's more significant than simply saying, all you said at the beginning is vaginal rape, now you're saying vaginal and anal rape. And I think there's a distinction there. It might be subtle, but to a criminal defendant, it's important.
So just to be clear, at trial, you're not going to seek to prove that she made a false report of the other rape, and therefore the jury should infer that her first report is also false. You're not going to try to prove that.
That's not our argument, Your Honor. Our argument is focused on the allegations against Mr. Hagerman.
So it's merely a matter of how you can cross-examine her about her statements to medical personnel concerning defendant's conduct toward her.
Primarily, Your Honor, and obviously any rebuttal.
What do you mean primarily? I'm sorry.
All I meant was, and in addition to cross-examining her, obviously if there are any rebuttal witnesses that would need to be called based on the testimony of the complainant. So if she testifies something inconsistent with what's in the record, then obviously we would perhaps call Dr. Hansen.
So you have, so it seems like you are challenging, it sounds like from your oral argument, you are challenging the application of the rape shield law. You're saying that, are you saying this evidence is not made inadmissible by the rape shield law, or that it is simply, the rape shield law doesn't apply, or what? I'm not clear.
I'm saying that it's relevant evidence that the rape shield law is supposed, regardless of rape shield, relevant evidence is admissible. And this evidence is relevant for purposes of describing to a jury the way in which the complainant has told her version of what she claims happened.
Now, isn't it true under the case law that simply because otherwise relevant evidence is excluded by, let's say, a special evidentiary rule like the rape shield law, that in itself is not enough to show a constitutional violation, is it?
I think my understanding of rape shield is that it doesn't necessarily, it stresses the importance of excluding irrelevant evidence pertaining to a person's, a complainant's prior sexual history, sexual consensual and non-consensual conduct. It's highlighting the importance of that, but it doesn't change the fact that relevant evidence is relevant as long as it isn't highly prejudicial. It's my position that rape shield doesn't, because of the constitutional rights that a defendant has, the rape shield law can't change that. The defendant still has a right to, still has his constitutional due process rights regardless of the rape shield law. And the constitutional rights obviously always trump the statute and the rule.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
The district court was persuaded by a chain of events that didn't occur. So, respondent, and this is in the district court's order, the complainant also reported that she had rectal bleeding since the assault. Not true. However, less than 2 hours later, a physical exam revealed that there were no signs of rectal excoriations or tears and no bleeding was observed. Then, later that same day, the complainant told law enforcement that, blank, blank, defendant raped her vaginally and anally. This is in direct conflict with what she told her providers earlier that same day. That's not how it happened. There was significant delay, and she did not report it that way. So the district court was given a compressed timeline that doesn't exist. Now, they've corrected that mostly on appeal, but that's not what they told the district court, that's not what the district court found, and that's certainly not what the district court found compelling. The district court found compelling that this all happened on the same day. She claimed to be bleeding, they looked at her, she wasn't bleeding, and then she went and told the cops something different. That all happening on the same day has a different context than the way it actually played out.
But did the court consider that in the analysis, though, this rectal bleeding? Because I understand from the records that the order was that she said, I had rectal bleeding from the second rape, and correct me if I'm wrong, and then she said, but it had lessened, you know, it was scant, and then she said it basically, she wasn't bleeding by the time they did the exam, and she indicated that before they did the exam.
Correct.
Is that sequence the correct sequence?
Yes.
Did the district court, was that utilized by the district court in its analysis of whether there was a reasonable probability of falsehood?
The district court never articulated why exactly he was finding a reasonable probability of falsity.
Well, he mentioned the two. He said there's inconsistent statements.
Right, but without
the paragraph where he says there's reasonable probability, and that's the only thing he mentions.
So. Right, but never says this is the discrepancy. Just he exactly follows respondents' claims that there are these inconsistencies without actually stating what these inconsistencies are. What he does do is block quote from respondent and block quote that inaccurate timeline, and then find that the credibility of the complainant will inevitably be paramount, and then follow that up by explaining that all of these things happen that same day, later that same day. It's a timeline that didn't happen.
Well, can I ask you another question? And this is based upon the argument of the respondent here. And that's that in order to show that, you know, to basically emphasize that she told the doctor it was only a vaginal rape for the first rape, she needs to show that she reported at the very same time a second rape that was an anal rape, and that bolsters her argument that it was a vaginal, that she knew the difference between the two, and that she made the distinction as she's explaining it to the doctor. How do you respond to that argument?
I don't know what the evidence will ultimately be. I mean, it's clear from the single, I mean, again, all we have is this one sentence from one doctor, and so it's sort of an aside. So it certainly wasn't the focus of what was going on. So I don't know if the complainant will even remember making that statement. It is clear she was under the influence of drugs because she's still fuzzy and says exactly that in that statement. So her memory is clearly impaired at that point. But under really any circumstance, there's even now, there's no articulation of how a true separate rape is in any way relevant to her case.
Well, apropos of that, is it relevant if it shows confusion of events? Because she was fuzzy about events.
Well, if it shows confusion of events as far as...
Not that the second one was false, but that the details of the two events were confused in her mind.
The level of detail, when you look at the level of detail given in the police report and the truly extraordinary rape explained in detail in that report, and you juxtapose that with that one tiny sentence, it is simply incomprehensible that that would have been the case. So they're free to question her about her memory and about her reporting about Hagerman's rape, but there is nothing that would allow them to put in front of the jury that this victim was also raped by somebody else.
I'm going to ask you one last question. Counsel has made the argument that the due process rights of her client require that any relevant evidence be admitted under the rape shield law. How do you respond to that argument?
Case law is crystal clear that there is no any relevant evidence clears the hurdle of due process. Relevant evidence can still be excluded. Valid defenses can still be excluded without violating constitutional due process. Cases cited in the state's brief say exactly that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We will take the matter under advisement. It's a very interesting case, and we will issue a decision within the statutory period of time. Thank you for your arguments today.